campus of the University of Illinois. Here is your moderator, John Paul.
And good evening. Thanks for joining us tonight. The issue of health care in the United States has been getting attention for a long time, but it always seems to get more of the spotlight during the presidential campaigns, and this election year, 2004, is absolutely no different. Tonight, we'll be comparing the health care proposals of President George Bush and Senator John Kerry. It may give you a better glimpse of where the campaigns stand on the issues affecting your health. Tonight, we'll focus the discussion in three primary areas, the first being medical malpractice and quality of health care, the second, Medicaid and Medicare, and the third, the uninsured and access to health care. With us tonight, representing the Bush and Kerry campaigns, first from the Republicans, State Senator Dale Ryder of Mattoon. He is here for the President Bush's campaign. From the Democrats today, Dr. Stephen Lelyveld, who is a pediatrician and professor of medicine from the University of Chicago. He is here representing the John Kerry campaign. Also with us tonight, our panel of experts. First, Professor David Hyman. He is from the College of Law and College of Medicine and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Robert Kestner is here from the Department of Economics at the University of Illinois Chicago and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs in Chicago. Richard Kaplan is here from the College of Law in Champaign. And Professor Noreen Shugru is here from the College of Nursing at both the University of Illinois Chicago and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Now, we are also joined in studio tonight in Urbana by a group of guests who will get their chance to question our experts about many of the aspects about health care. It's time now to get things started. Let's turn first to Professor David Hyman for an overview of health care in this election year. Professor.
Thanks, John. I'm going to just start giving a brief overview of ways of thinking about the issue of health care in this election. Health policy analysts typically divide the issues into three. First, cost. Second, quality. Third, access. And a lot of the discussion that you're going to hear tonight, you can usefully think about simply in light of that three legs that support the stool of health care. The second thing I wanted to do is talk a little bit about what's at stake in terms of the size of the money that flows into the healthcare sector of the economy. Healthcare is about 14% of our gross domestic product. That comes to $1.6 trillion a year. If you look at who's paying that, at least in terms of who writes the last check, state and federal governments are responsible for about 45% of that. Private insurance is responsible for about 35% of it, and individual contributions are responsible for the remainder. Strictly speaking, all of that money comes out of individual pockets. The government raises money through taxes, and so it comes from the pockets of the citizens. If you look at where that money goes, about 30% goes to hospitals, about 20% goes to physicians and for clinical services, although physicians obviously control a much larger share of how the healthcare dollar is spent. About 10% goes for pharmaceuticals, and the remainder is split among long-term care, administrative expenses, and a variety of other things that we spend money on. Two other points I wanted to make. First of all, people have different preferences about health policy because they rank those three big ideas differently. Some people care a great deal about the cost of their own health insurance. Other people care more about how much the government is spending to provide care through the Medicare and Medicaid programs. Some people focus on quality. Some people focus on access. And so what the viewers need to think about is, how do the positions that I'm hearing match up with my own preferences? The last point is the panelists from the University of Illinois prepared a document that's available on WILL's website, electinghealthcare.org, that provides a lot more detail than we'll have time to give tonight.
So if you need to find out more, you can go to www.electinghealthcare.org for more information about what the experts have to say tonight. Well, let's turn things now to our representatives from each of the campaigns. We'll start first with the representative from the George Bush campaign, Senator Ryder. Senator Ryder, tell us a little bit about the overall Bush health care proposals.
Well, I think that probably for both campaigns, certainly the Bush campaign, you can divide it into two separate issues. One is the desire and the incentives or proposals we put forth to cover those who are low income, age blind or disabled, populations who truly cannot provide for themselves. In the second half, I would put the people who are on the margins, people who work but their employer doesn't afford them an employer-sponsored health insurance package and things like that. Both campaigns, I think, and certainly the Bush campaign, wants to see that first category, the former category, covered, and we do it through government programs. most notably, in the Medicaid program, which is the combination of the state federal program, in order to alter the basic incentives that you might offer, a state has to obtain a waiver from the federal government. The Bush administration, since it came into office, has been very, very flexible in offering waivers, which the state of Illinois has taken advantage of, primarily to expand coverage to different kinds of coverages and to change the population of the people that we cover. In other words, increase eligibility, which is something that we've wanted to do. Now in the state of Illinois, the taxpayers will cover the health care for the cost of your children if you make up to 200% of the federal poverty level, which is just under $40,000 a year for a family of four. Additionally, the family care program, which again was created in part through a waiver through the federal government, pays for health care on a sliding scale for the entire family if they make up to 133% of the federal poverty level. So one of the important things I think that the Bush administration has seen is that the states need the flexibility to care for the populations as they deem appropriate. Additionally, the Bush administration is working to, by 2006, open an additional 1,200 community health centers. And these are very important, whether you're talking about the inner city or we're talking about the rural areas, such as like what I represent. It is often difficult for people of low incomes and limited means to drive all the way to the hospital or get to the specialist they need to get to, and so their first encounter with the health care system can be these community health care centers. On the second subject, with regards to those people kind of on the margins, 45 million Americans approximately don't have health insurance. That number has gone up for 3 years in a row. 4 years in a row, the premiums, the average cost for health insurance premiums, have gone up by double-digit numbers. Those two numbers are linked. We have one in part because we have the other. And the Bush administration proposals to try to bring more people into the private insurance market through the use of tax credits, tax deductions, association health plans, allowing small businesses to combine with one another and create their own health insurance pools or buy from commercial providers are designed to bring the cost down, cover more people through bringing the average cost of the health insurance premiums down. And I think that that's an incremental step, and there isn't any question about that. But I think that this problem is vexing enough and complex enough that there isn't a single wave of a magic wand and make this problem disappear.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Ryder. Dr. Lilleveld, on behalf of Senator Kerry's campaign, give us a brief overview of where the senator stands when it comes to health care.
Well, first of all, we both are on the same page in thinking that there are big gaps in the health care system right now. The number of uninsured people in the United States has dramatically increased in the last few years. Since 2000, there's an additional 5.2 million people uninsured. We have an SCHIP program to provide care for children. In spite of that, 8.5 million children in the United States do not have health insurance. Premiums for the average worker have gone up 64% by about $3,500 to a total of $9,900 average for a family of four in the Bush years. There has been time to try to address some of these issues. We think that President Bush's attempts to expand the program in the private sector don't go far enough. Senator Kerry thinks that we need to expand the program even further. Part of this is a difference in approach. As the federal government under President Bush has been contracting federal dollars to the state budgets are squeezed. they then have to squeeze people out of their system to balance their budgets. And the number of insured, even though we have best efforts to insure these children and adults, the numbers of uninsured increase. The states pay lower rates, and there is a direct link between rates paid by the state for these Medicare and Medicaid children and adults to access of care. That was just shown in a federal suit in Chicago, the Memosofsky suit, where there's a direct link between payment for service and access to care. Senator Kerry would expand access to care by expanding what would be required of the states to have children up to 300% of poverty and adults up to 200% of poverty for access to family coverage, not as a requirement so much as an incentive. If the states would do this, then the federal government would pick up the tab so that we would have a larger role for the states to bring 100% of children and 95% of adults into the insured pool through these programs. If you have a higher number of insured population coming to seek health care, then there's no cost shifting that's going on right now, or less cost shifting to the private patients, and it becomes a more equitable system. And in sum, we're expanding the care, looking at quality as well. A second pillar of the Kerry campaign is the use of technology. We have computers now that will help us manage diseases, help us look for and identify errors before they happen in the prescription of drugs if we use computerized prescribing. If we used electronic billing, we could get rid of a lot of waste, you know, all the paperwork that physicians and offices have to do, squeeze these costs that are estimated at $350 million of the $1.6 trillion annual health care budget. That's money that could be available for actual care and help fund these systems. Malpractice does occur. Senator Kerry wants to decrease that as well. He opposes caps on malpractice, but definitely thinks that we need to cut down on the number of malpractice suits. Frivolous suits that are filed have a penalty for lawyers who file frivolous suits, and be sure that if there is a true error, that the money that would be generated to help cover that patient's harm actually go to the patient.
Okay, we will get back to our representatives from the campaigns in a minute. Let's turn to the experts for their view on some of those three issues that we talked about at the beginning of the show. Let's go back first to David Hyman for a look at quality of health care and medical malpractice. Professor Hyman.
Well, quality is actually an issue that periodically bursts into the public eye. In 1999, there was a report from the Institute of Medicine called To Err is Human that got a tremendous amount of public attention, because what it did was it framed the issue of quality in terms of the number of Americans that were killed every year in hospitals as a result of medical errors. We actually know a lot about quality. At its best, the quality of American health care is really extraordinary. But far too often, the quality is not what it could be or should be. And there's lots of evidence to indicate that many Americans don't get the quality of care that they're paying for. And you can look in any area of health care. It doesn't matter who's paying for the care. It doesn't matter where it's provided. It doesn't matter whether it's inpatient or outpatient. It doesn't matter where in the country it's being delivered. There's lots of evidence to indicate quality is not what it should be. And that has real consequences in terms of people living with disabilities that actually are remediable, people dying prematurely, people suffering long-term pain, and people paying out of pocket for care that doesn't deliver for them what they need. And we can talk more about that. There's actually a very extensive body of research that I think pretty much everybody agrees on at this point, that quality is not what it could be. Now let's talk about malpractice, which is the way the legal system tries to deal with the problem of quality not being what it should be. And let me just mention for people who aren't aware of it, the word negligence is a word lawyers throw around. What it means is somebody wasn't as careful as a reasonably prudent person would have been. And the way the legal system works is if you're negligent, so the person that you've injured can recover from you for the costs of that negligence. And those costs come in both economic, that's wages and medical expenses, and non-economic forms. And individuals go find private lawyers to sue physicians who they believe were negligent, and either the case gets settled or the case goes to trial, and it sort of plays out one of two different ways, depending upon whether the judge or jury believes the physician was negligent or not. A couple of numbers to help sort of frame this issue. The best estimate is that 1% of hospitalized patients get negligently injured. That's a remarkably high number, okay? It sounds really good if you say 99% of people aren't negligently injured, but 1% negligently injured is a lot of people every day, everywhere in the United States that get negligently injured. Of that 1%, only 1 in 50 files a lawsuit, okay? So it's a very small percentage of the people who are negligently injured actually file a lawsuit. But if you look at the lawsuits that are filed, a lot of them are filed by people who were not negligently injured, okay? And that's in some ways even a very small error rate in filing lawsuits. If 99% of people aren't negligently injured, a very small percentage of them filing lawsuits is still a lot of lawsuits. And so what we have is both an underfiling problem, that is a lot of people who are negligently injured never bring a lawsuit, and an overfiling problem, a lot of people who weren't negligently injured do file. And the legal system does a not perfect, but a respectable job in sorting things out. But the truth of the matter is, a lot of the time, payments are made to people who weren't negligently injured. That doesn't mean they're not injured. Okay. The best predictor of a payment is disability. It's not whether you were negligently injured or not.
Professor Hyman, how are we to judge the Kerry and Bush campaigns on those issues?
Well, the difficulty is both sides are against frivolous litigation, but it's very hard to quantify what counts as frivolous litigation. There are no good studies of frivolous litigation, and actually, there are lots of reasons why you wouldn't expect huge amounts of it, because private lawyers only bring lawsuits when they expect to recover. And filing a frivolous lawsuit is not a great way to make money if there are lots of negligently injured people out there who you could file a lawsuit on behalf of. Okay? And again, this goes to the disability being the predictor. Lots and lots of people are injured by medical treatment. Whether they were negligently injured is a different question. So everybody's against frivolous litigation, but it's hard to have any sense of how serious that problem is because there's no good data on that point. I think we'll debate a little bit later the virtues and costs of caps. I didn't want to get into that level of detail right now. What I wanted instead to focus on was quality's not what it could be, and the medical malpractice system isn't perfect either.
Okay, thank you, Professor. We appreciate your views on that, and we will get back again, as we said, to our representatives from the campaigns to talk about the issues in just a few minutes. Let's turn our discussion of the topic now to Medicaid and to Professor Robert Kestner from the University of Illinois Chicago from an economist viewpoint. Tell us about that issue.
Well, John, the central issue for Medicaid is the growing cost of the program. It's a program that provides health insurance to low-income people, including the aged and disabled, and it's jointly funded by the state and federal government. The state share is roughly 50%. The growing cost of becoming an increasing burden on state budgets. In most states, Medicaid represents is the second biggest budget item in the state budget, behind education. So it's a growing burden, and states are having difficulty providing the level of quality of care to all the people that they feel need such care, and as a consequence, they have to make some adjustments in light of the budgetary situation. Some of those adjustments are paying providers a very low payment rate. And as has been mentioned already, that this will adversely affect people's access to care and the quality of that care. And the other alternative that states face is cutting back on the program and restricting its the eligibility of certain people, so some people don't get the care that they need. The candidate's position on this issue is are quite different. Here there's a real difference in the candidate's position. President Bush's position is to first try to encourage enrollment among those who are eligible, the low-income children, near-poor children. Let's make a public relations campaign and get everybody who is eligible enrolled in the program. And the other thing, the other policy that President has proposed, which Senator Ryder has mentioned, are these waivers that allow states to restructure their program to make it more efficient so that they can serve more people. And importantly, these waivers are supposed to be cost neutral and not increase cost or decrease the cost of the program. On the other hand, Senator Kerry has a very a much larger program planned that to expand the coverage the Medicaid program and its closely related SCHIP program. Medicaid covers about 20 million children. Senator Kerry proposes to, instead of having the cost split between the state and federal government 50-50, Senator Kerry proposes the federal government will take over 100% of those costs for the 20 million people. In return, states will have to expand coverage to groups that don't have insurance now, a little higher up on the income scale. But the trade-off will be very beneficial to states. It'll create it'll help the states' fiscal position and relieve some of the budgetary pressure that the states are currently facing. So states might be able to raise provider payments. The cost is very significant for the Kerry program. It's going to be a very costly type of program. And that's a fundamental difference between the two candidates on this.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor. We need to turn our next topic to the issue of Medicare. And for that, we turn to Professor Richard Kaplan from the College of Law at the University of Illinois. Professor, tell us a little bit about Medicare and where the two campaigns stand.
John, Medicare is a very different sort of program, in the sense that access to care is increasingly a problem, but everyone is already eligible. That is, people who are 65 and over, people who are disabled, are belonging to this entitlement program, and so there you don't have the situation of older people who are uninsured. Since 1965, Medicare has provided the closest thing that this country has to universal health insurance. The problem with Medicare is, what does it cover? It's done pretty well with hospitals and physician visits, but has had two major gaps. One is long-term care, and the other is prescription drugs. Prescription drugs has been an issue now for almost 10 years, but it's been largely taken off the table because last year, the Bush administration was able to get through Congress a Medicare Act, which, while not terribly satisfactory to a lot of constituencies, does tackle the issue of prescription drugs in the Medicare program. Prescription drugs wasn't a major component of health care in 1965, and so this is a major revisiting of what Medicare should cover. At the same time, there are these discount drug cards that people are trying to struggle with, no fewer than 73 options, and in less than 15 months, there will be a new Part D benefit that is already fairly complicated because it's a compromise between a variety of people who wanted a catastrophic care benefit and others who wanted to make sure that everyone was included. Part of the point is that there was coverage for prescription drugs even before this new act. I have a graphic that is in the form of a pie chart that shows that before the Medicare Act was enacted, nearly 3 out of 4 Medicare beneficiaries had some form of drug coverage. The reason this was a salient issue, however, is that many of the components of that drug coverage were either unstable or insecure. For example, the biggest component was employer-sponsored health benefit plans for retirees. Those plans are being cut back. Those plans are seeing huge increases in premiums, and in many cases have a restricted formulary. The Medigap policies that people can purchase on their own do not have restricted formularies, but they are very expensive, and many times people find that the premiums, which are completely uncontrolled, go outside their reach. Finally, you have Medicare managed care plans, which typically do cover drugs, but many people have found those to be unreliable, as large numbers of Medicare managed care arrangements have literally pulled out of the Medicare market. So as a result, even though 3 out of 4 people had drug coverage before this act, there was a great deal of interest in getting a drug benefit in Medicare, and that's what the new act does. The two campaigns have a very different approach. President Bush exerted a fair amount of pressure and expended a lot of political capital to get that bill into law. At the present time, their position is, let's give it a chance, let's implement it, let's try to explain it, let's get people enrolled. The Senator Kerry's campaign, however, wants to revisit a number of features, not typically the complex tier of benefits, but things that are a little easier to understand. For example, one of the provisions of this act actually forbids Medicare from negotiating discount prices with pharmaceutical companies. Senator Kerry's campaign wants to repeal that provision. Another provision deals with importation of drugs from Canada. Again, a marked difference between the two campaigns. In addition to the prescription drug benefit area, there's also the issue of long-term care, where Senator Kerry has a variety of proposals, including increased reimbursement, care for or support for informal caregivers, and a few other details that we can get into while President Bush's campaign is really not focused on that issue.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor. Let's turn our attention now to the issue of access to health care and the uninsured. And for that, we turn to Professor Noreen Shugrue from the College of Nursing at the University of Illinois and the University of Chicago. Professor Shugrue, it seems like we hear a lot of attention being paid to those who don't have insurance. Where do the campaigns stand on these issues?
Well, where the campaigns stand on these issues is they both see this as a priority in their domestic policy agenda, but in fact they have very different proposals. They also have some common philosophical attitudes towards how they want to solve the problem. But before we do that, I'd like to talk a little bit about who are these 45 million uninsured people. As Professor Kaplan noted, less than 1% of the uninsured are over 65. That means that the uninsured are working adults and young children. 48% of the uninsured are white, 16% are black, 5% are Asian, and 29% are Hispanic. 80% of uninsured people live in working families, and 73% are native-born Americans. So the picture of the uninsured are really working Americans, our neighbors, our colleagues, our friends. What the candidates are proposing is that they look at how to enhance coverage. Neither campaign really speaks clearly to the issue of access. In terms of their proposals, they have very similar attitudes towards the support of an employer-based health insurance system, and neither campaign is willing to offer proposals that cover all Americans. As Professor Kessner pointed out, the Kerry campaign is much more willing to use the federal government to enhance coverage and eligibility through the Medicaid program and through the Children's Health Insurance Benefit Program. Senator Kerry also is willing to use the resources of the federal government to entice employers to cover more workers. So, for example, he is proposing that companies that cover all workers would be eligible for up to 75% reimbursement of cost accrued to them because of catastrophic health care costs. This is not something that the president is willing to support or is proposing. He contends that the current system of tax incentives and tax rebates is enough to entice employers to offer coverage to their workers. Senator Ryder talked about the laudable goal of increasing the number of community clinics in rural America and urban America by 1,200. The problem is that the clinics that are in existence today are hard to staff, and their financing is a crisis their administrators deal with every day, and the president has not proposed any way to either staff or fund these clinics. And finally, there's the whole question of how are they going to pay for these proposals. Senator Kerry proposes taking a tax rollback to people who earn $200,000 or more and earmarking it for programs for the uninsured, President Bush, unfortunately, has not given us any specifics as to how he will pay for an expansion of programs for the uninsured. I think the issue that the viewers want to ask themselves is, when thinking about the problem of uninsured, does either campaign offer proposals which fundamentally address the issue of the uninsured? And the answer is no, because at the end of the day, Senator Kerry's proposals leave 17 million people uninsured, while President Bush's proposals would leave between 27 and 34 million Americans with no health insurance.
Thank you, Professor. Let's turn back to our representatives from the campaigns. First, this time from the Kerry campaign, Dr. Lelyveld. What have you heard from the experts that you want to address?
Well, I think the biggest issue is, how do you get people with no insurance into the system and get them insured? A fundamental part of the Kerry plan is not universal access through a federally run universal care similar to Europe and Canada and other parts of the industrialized world. He's taken the base of the private sector and tried to expand the private sector to incentivize employers to offer insurance through their own programs to their employees. Right now, people are working hard, but fewer and fewer businesses are offering health insurance through their jobs. So he's trying to expand that, number one. Number two, trying to take the pressure off states that currently have this huge gap in their health care budgets from lack of funding, and put that money back into the system and get these people who are making 200 to 300% of poverty, get these 8.5 million children that are missed back on the rolls. Our children are our future. They're the ones who are going to care for us in our old age, and they're the ones who are going to really need to be healthy and have a good start. And so the Kerry plan, getting 100% of kids into the insured role, I think is a prime laudable goal. And ultimately, 95% of the population insured through either the working poor through the state government and the non-working poor through state government, and workers at the lower and middle incomes that are getting squeezed by their employers.
Okay, thank you, Doctor. Senator Ryder, your response to anything you heard from the experts regarding health care plans of the president?
With regards, I guess, first I think that we need to make a distinction, and it's a critical distinction, between eligibility for a program and access. The federal court decision that was referenced earlier, the basic tenet of that ruling is that children who are already eligible under the state's Medicaid program are being denied access equal to that of children who are in the private insurance market. The reason I make that point is this, is that simply expanding the rolls, bringing in more people into a government-sponsored insurance program, doesn't mean that you're taking care necessarily of the access problem, especially if you are devoting a greater and greater percentage of your tax dollars to bringing more people on the rolls rather than shoring up the foundations of the system. That's the problem we have here in Illinois. As we continue to increase the income thresholds or the amount of money that a person or a family can make and still qualify for Medicaid, we leave the providers terribly inadequately reimbursed. That's the crux of the federal decision. Because the providers are not adequately reimbursed, fewer and fewer of them are willing to take part in the Medicaid system. When fewer of them are willing to take part in the Medicaid system, those children who we've brought onto the rolls are still not going to be able to access that health care because there aren't enough providers out there. By way of a correction, I don't think that the president believes that the current mix of tax incentives, tax credits, or whatever, is adequate with regards to businesses bringing employees onto the insurance rolls. That's why he's proposed many new ones, the association health plans, to allow small businesses to pool together, to be more of a force when they go to an insurer and say, we need to buy health insurance for our employees. The bigger pool, obviously, they have, the better price they're going to negotiate, the more people are going to be covered. So I think that the president is moving forward in a way that recognizes, again, that the biggest problem that we have with the uninsured is that the uninsured can't afford the health insurance premiums. So we have to find a way to bring the cost of the health insurance premiums down. Expanding the government programs won't do anything with regards to that cost. One last point. Senator Kerry's proposal to offer states 100% of the cost to cover children is laudable, but of course it comes with a hook, like most federal programs do. And me being a state legislator, I've got a little experience with that. We're going to be forced to expand our eligibility requirements. Now, maybe that'll be a net savings to the state. Maybe it won't. Even if it is, I mean, in my district, and I think it's true in all states, the dollars that the federal government takes out of my constituents' pockets are just as green as the dollars that the state government does. So, I mean, we can talk about state government and federal government, and it's appropriate to talk about different levels of government with regards to responsibility, but we need to remember that we're all paying for it. It's just we're writing a check to a different entity.
All right. Well, it is time now for us to turn our attention to the studio audience that has patiently been waiting for an opportunity to question our experts and our representatives from the Kerry and Bush campaign. We ask that our speaker come forward, a microphone right next to me here, have them step to the microphone, identify him or herself, who they're affiliated with, and ask our question to our experts. So I'll turn my back to you for a second and ask them to step up if they have a question. As they come forward, I'm going to go ahead and ask a question in the meantime, because I know they're anxious to ask questions. Let me start with that issue of cost. The Kerry plan is estimated to cost around $650 billion. The Bush plan is cheaper. Is there a reason, therefore, to favor the Bush plan simply from the aspect of cost? And I'll throw that out to anyone who cares to jump into that.
Well, let me actually make 2 points. The first is the estimate that you gave. It was a revised downward estimate from an earlier substantially larger estimate, and there's a substantially larger estimate done by the American Enterprise Institute. So, you know, the nature of the estimates, particularly estimates about government programs, I think enough said on that subject.
But how do we judge cost and judge one campaign against the other?
See, this is the point that I started with, that different voters will have different preferences about how they balance cost versus access. You know, the issue, as Noreen put it, was, you know, the Kerry plan will cover more of the currently uninsured, but at a substantially greater price tag. So the issue is simply, are you willing to pay the extra amount in order to cover more people? And do you believe that the estimates are realistic?
I also think we need to keep in mind that even if we don't cover more people because we think we're saving costs by going with a plan that covers less, those people still show up in emergency rooms, they still get admitted to hospitals, and that cost is borne primarily by the government through disproportionate share payments and other payments, or the hospitals pick that up through uncompensated care or uncollected debt, and those costs are passed on to the rest of us at some point.
Okay, let's go with a question from our audience. Go ahead, identify yourself and go ahead.
I'm Ken Prenton, a surgeon from Evanston, Illinois, and I'm the current president of the Illinois Medical Society. We have a problem with access here in this state, not only among the poor, which is certainly there and getting bigger, but we have a problem with access also in people who really do have insurance but are running out of physicians to go to in a variety of communities in this state. And everybody used to think it was just downstate. It's downstate, it's in Chicago, it's in a lot of places where we don't have not only specialized care but also primary care, because the physicians have moved out in response to, number one, increasing malpractice insurance costs, and number two, the lack of caps in this state. And I wonder what the respective campaigns have in mind to improve the access for all the patients in states where there are crisis situations existing in malpractice litigation.
Mr. Ryder.
Well, obviously, one major difference between the president's campaign and Senator Kerry's campaign is that President Bush has already demonstrated very forcefully that he supports caps on non-economic damages. He has a piece of legislation which has passed the United States House of Representatives. It's been stalled in the United States Senate that would, among other things, impose a $250,000 cap on non-economic damages. The electing health care document that you referred to earlier states itself that large awards can be important factors, again, in the cost of health care and health care insurance. And another issue there is to remember that insurance companies set rates based, one important factor is predictability. Well, when you don't have caps on non-economic damages, there's absolutely no predictability about what the awards might be. That's part of the reason that you see these wildly increasing medical malpractice premiums in this state and other states without caps, because there's no predictability there. A lot of people refer to this issue as the medical malpractice insurance crisis. It's a healthcare issue because, as the doctor just said, it dramatically affects access that we have.
Dr. Lilligall?
We have seen that in southern Illinois, neurosurgeons have fled and there's no neurosurgery down south because malpractice premiums are through the roof. We've seen OB-GYN doctors practicing on the North Shore of Chicago start and have their practices flip from the northern suburbs over the line to Wisconsin, to Racine. It is a real problem. Senator Kerry proposes several things that will be very important and that the Medical Society also supports. Number one, have a case certified by a physician in the specialty to which the person feels they were injured. For instance, I'm a pediatric ER doc. If something happens to one of the children that I care for, have another pediatric ER doc or an ER doc or someone who practices similar to me certify that I did something wrong. Don't go off and have a dermatologist say that I've done something wrong when they don't know how I practice. That's number one. Make it more incentivized for the states to pass bills to have arbitration so that there is a group of people that will meet prior to any trial to look at the case and see if there really is a damage, and if there really is a damage, then to figure out what it really is worth and to be sure that money gets into the pocket of the patient who needs it. And have a three strikes, you're out for lawyers, so that if a lawyer files three frivolous lawsuits in a row, then that lawyer would be barred from having another lawsuit filed for 10 years. I think these are all types of things that we can support. There is malpractice that does occur. There are bad outcomes. We've discussed that at length. It's more a question of being sure the patients that are harmed are cared, and the senator has a plan. In addition to that, pass a true patient's bill of rights so that a patient in an HMO has a right to appeal a medical decision by a non-medical person. Let that person who needs to see a medical specialist have access to a medical specialist. Let there be access to real emergency care rather than be gatekeeped away from seeing an ER care, and an external appeals process for HMOs should they make a ruling against you so you can actually get the care that you need.
Let's suppose that instead of me being a healthcare consumer, that I'm a healthcare provider in this case, either a doctor or a hospital or a nursing home. How do I judge these two campaigns from that standpoint, from the standpoint of the healthcare provider? David, what would you say that? If I'm a provider in this case, how should I be judging the Bush campaign or the Kerry campaign?
It's an interesting question, John. One issue for providers is the size and speed of the payments they receive for rendering care to Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries. A related issue is how many people are going to come to their door. And I guess a third issue would be, as we've already heard, malpractice and the extent to which you would think the campaign's proposals match up with what you think the problems are and what makes sense as solutions. I mean, I'm not, you're not asking me to tell the providers which one to vote for, I take it. So
no, I won't
I
go that
stop
far.
There.
We'll go that far. Thank you, Professor Ryan. A question.
Thank you. I'm Ken Robbins, and I'm president of the Illinois Hospital Association, one of those providers. The rhetoric of health reform seems to go something like this. We want higher quality, greater access, and lower cost. And I would posit that it is not possible in today's political environment to have all three of those things. Two of them, perhaps, but not all three. And so I would ask either the representatives of the campaigns or the experts how they would prioritize, because I find that the proposals that are on the table now, frankly, are inadequate and are making those trade-offs. And I think we need to have a conversation about that.
Thanks for your question. Dr. Lellerville, would you like to speak about that first?
Well, I think that the first priority of the Kerry campaign would have to be access to care. We have to have everyone who is ill in America or who needs preventive care in America have some way of getting care. Currently, the system freezes out a very significant population in the United States. These are the people who don't seek care and end up seeing people like me in the emergency room after their diseases have gone too far, or just plain don't get care. So access to care would be number one. A corollary of that has to be improving quality, looking at our safety net, investing more in the safety net hospitals and providers to be sure that when that catastrophe happens to that uninsured or poorly insured person, there's a place for them to go so that our population at least stays alive and healthy as best as we can do it.
Senator Ryder, what do you see as a priority for the Bush campaign?
I think I would tend to agree, but again, I think that you don't easily divide access and cost and quality. I think that there's an overlap among the three. And again, I don't think that you automatically increase access to health care, certainly not a quality manner, simply by reaching out with larger arms with a government program and covering more people. I think that the best way to do that, again, and this, I think this is the Bush's campaign approach, is to work within the existing system and try to create incentives by which people insure themselves by themselves or through their employers. They are also that way better able to be in control of the quality care they are getting because they're choosing it and you don't have someone from the government choosing it.
Okay. Go ahead with your question. You have a question.
I'm Jackie Ziff, Vice President of Planned Parenthood of East Central Illinois. And I've heard this mentioned and I'd like an answer to this question. If the buying associations supported by President Bush are allowed, what safeguards are proposed to ensure that women would receive insurance coverage for birth control and other reproductive health services?
Okay, thank you. Senator Ryder?
I don't know that there would be, just to be perfectly honest. And here's why I say that is because one of the true problems we have with cost is mandates. Every year in Springfield and every year in Washington, the legislators get together and they come up with 50 new ways to provide what they think is going to be better health care for their constituents and tell the insurance companies they have to pay for it. That contributes to that cost inflation, which keeps so many people uninsured in this country altogether. So one of the ways that you're going to have to allow the cost to be watered down a little bit is to walk away from some of those mandates where it is appropriate. Now, it should be remembered that in joining these association health plans, individuals or the employers are going to have the voluntary choice whether or not to join that plan or not. And then that plan can voluntarily choose whether or not to purchase an insurance plan that has XYZ mandate. So there isn't any question that going that approach is going to allow for more flexibility. But if you don't do that, you won't reduce the cost. You won't insure more people.
Dr. Lellerville,
I think it's also fair to say, though, that the association buying plans will not have any safeguards because one of their conditions is that they are beyond the reach of state regulatory agencies to ensure certain minimal standards of care. And so, for instance, if you have an association which President Bush calls like-minded and like-valued people coming together, and they choose not to provide any type of, as the questioner asked, services for birth control or reproductive health, then those would not be there. And if that is who your employer has signed up with, then the women working for that person would have no options.
Yeah, quick response, Dr. Lellerville.
Whether you're talking about birth control pills or Viagra or anything else along these lines, Senator Kerry is very clear in his message that ideology, religion, personal ethics should have no trump card over science and the needs of a population, and that, among other things, choice to take the pill or not take the pill means choice for individuals in this country, and whether you choose to do it or not, it's still choice.
Okay, let's move to another question. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Janet Thorlton. I'm a doctoral student at the University of Illinois. And my question is, if we have approximately 50 million uninsured people, and within the next few years we are able to arrive at insuring at least half of them, if these people are all going to begin accessing the system that is already overloaded and understaffed, what might the plan be to make provisions to be able to staff healthcare facilities with additional nurses, nurses' aides, that type of thing?
Okay, thank you very much. Anybody want to tackle that issue?
There is no plan.
I can start sense that Noreen and I were actually on a healthcare task force about 2 years ago under the direction of former Secretary of Labor Lynn Martin. And one of the issues that that task force dealt with is that there is a national shortage of nurses at every level, particularly of the sorts that nursing homes and continuing care retirement communities and assisted living facilities need. That is not the registered nurse level, because this country has moved to allow free immigration of registered nurses from any country. But at levels beyond or below the registered nurse, we have a major shortage coming even under the current situation. And I think the questioner's point is a very important one, that if we have more people in the system, that's going to increase the demand for a whole variety of specialties, and including the ones who provide this kind of custodial and day-to-day care. The systems are overstressed now. There are actually surgical wards that are declining surgeries because they do not have the nurses. Well, that filters down to all of the other components of the healthcare system, and it's an issue that we really haven't faced. There is a Nurse Reinvestment Act that was passed about 2 years ago, but the government provided no funds for that, and so it's still very much a work in progress as terms of how to get more people to go into nursing and to go into a wide variety of nursing activities, because even apart from the issue that the questioner raised, we have the baby boomers coming up, and they're going to want more care, more feeding, and more tender, loving care that only nurses provide.
Nursing sounds like that's in your back pocket, Professor Shugru. Tell us a little bit about where this issue fits in.
The problem is that even if we could offer an education slot to every person who wanted to become a registered nurse today, which we cannot do, we would still be facing a severe nursing shortage. And very honestly, neither campaign has adequately addressed the issue. And as Professor Kaplan noted, the Nurse Reinvestment Act, while an interesting attempt, does not really do much to address the problem. And as I said, there's no proposals coming out of either campaign.
Okay, let's go to one last question here. Go ahead.
Hello. My name is Jeff Scott. I'm a doctoral student in the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. And if Senator Kerry were to be elected and was able to extend eligibility for Medicaid and CHIP, 15 million or so American adults would still remain uninsured. And I'm wondering who these people are and why they would continue to slip through the health care safety net.
Okay, thank you for your question. Dr. Lillyville.
The answer to that is we currently have far more people than that uninsured right now. We have to start somewhere. 300% of poverty level for children, which would basically get 100% of kids into the system, and 200% of poverty level for families. You add those two things together, you'll get 95% of America covered. It's a start. It's an expensive start. Ultimately, we want 100% of Americans to be covered. And just as an aside on the expansion of eligibility, Senator Kerry's proposal doesn't just expand eligibility. He expands eligibility and puts the dollars behind it to pay for it in a way that will make access to care actually happen.
Let me do a quick roundup here. Number one issue when it comes to health care that voters should be looking at the presidential campaign. Dr. Hyman.
It depends on the voter.
Is there one issue that rises to the top, the cream, so to speak, rather than others?
No, I think voters legitimately have different views about what issue matters most to them. And that's why I'll end where I started. People have different preferences on whether cost matters more than quality or the uninsured / access.
Professor Kaplan, if you had a number one voting issue.
It's interesting because 3 out of 4 people in polls claim that they're worried that Medicare is going to be around for them and will provide the same level of benefits. And so the issue for them is, will Medicare be sustained in light of some of the health care trends and costs that we're already seeing?
Number one issue, Professor Kestner.
Whether the $650 billion that Senator Kerry is planning to spend is worth it.
Professor Shakura.
If you're one of the 45 million people without insurance, It's the issue of the uninsured and access, and if you're one of the people with health insurance, I think it's cost.
Okay. Thank you very much, all of you, our panel tonight, our panel of experts, and our representatives from the Kerry campaign, Dr. Lilly Veld from the University of Illinois Chicago, from the Bush campaign, Senator Dale Ryder Senator Dale Ryder from the Bush campaign, and thank you for joining us. We hope you have learned more about health care in America and about whom you will vote for. Again, thanks for you for joining us tonight.
Coming up next at 8 o'clock, a debate between vice presidential candidates John Edwards and Dick Cheney. Presidential candidates George Bush and John Kerry will debate again on Thursday night, and you'll hear it live here on AM 580 beginning at 8 o'clock. Be sure to join us tomorrow morning for complete analysis of tonight's debate during Morning Edition from NPR News between 5 and 10 o'clock. For extensive campaign coverage and complete information on WILL's Election 2004 programming, log on to will.uiuc.edu. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, clear with some scattered frost forming after midnight, the overnight low 37, winds very light and from the southeast to south. Tomorrow sunny and warmer with a high of 73, southerly winds at 5 to 10. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Stay tuned for the vice presidential candidate debate next at 8 o'clock. Thank you.